Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, today joined by Notorious. And let's start off with our first news story, which when Herman and I read it, we just couldn't stop giggling to ourselves because of how ridiculous it is. Anyway, so this is a story from News24, reporting on the ANC is saying that it is going to be setting strict new requirements for its candidates. Election process as it goes into the local government elections in 2026. It's hoping to have its selection process for candidates wrapped up by the end of July 2026. As a sort of side note, this probably suggests that the party has maybe in mind a date at which it's going to set the next local government elections. But anyway, the party has given, from the article here, the party has given provincial structures a strict task of selecting quality members with no criminal record, all facing an internal disciplinary hearing. With the 2026 local government elections around the corner, Secretary General Mbulula has called on the party structure to commence with the selection processes of the leadership, including the mayors. He said the party needed to do this to be ready for the 2026 local government elections, now expected to take place at the end of 2026. Included in this were recommendations by Kgatlego Motlanthe, who said that we have a lot of problems in municipalities. And a source that News24 spoke to said that candidates are struggling to understand some simple things in some cases, and that the strict rules are aiming to change the image of the party, which had been appointing people who cannot read or interpret financial reports. So, Herman, am I being unfair to say that the ANC's bold new strategy in its candidate selection for 2026 is to appoint candidates who have no criminal record and are literate? This is not setting the bar particularly.
Well, at least there is a bar, it seems, which in the
Yeah,
world of progress is perhaps pickings.
this is what they call the buried lead, right? Which is that the implication of all of this is that having a criminal record, an internal ANC disciplinary process against you, and not being able to understand or read reports were not barriers to you being an ANC candidate up until now.
Yes, one is what the criteria has been for the last 30 years, and can't help but feel some sort of depressed joy at what those applications must have gone through, because both of us we've sort of heard some stories from inside other political parties about the sort of applications one gets for candidacy, and that is the level of application one gets is quite interesting, even with thresholds in place that are more strenuous than these. What is particularly tickling to me is the idea that not a need to change now to get quality candidates, but the assumption that the ANC has the ability to attract quality candidates, because we can look at a bit of history and a bit of research on this. Parties in decline fail to attract quality candidates. That is just a simple fact, because if you have a successful career or a comfortable retirement, you're not going to abandon it to join a party with declining electoral prospects, because you might invest a lot of your time, a lot of energy, and into actually not getting elected. So that's the first problem, is the ANC isn't a party on the rise. It is very much not. It is a party on decline. So even if it were to raise the threshold and say tertiary qualifications and stuff are necessary, it is a rather bold assumption that that would still help the ANC sort of recover its image as a party of elected competence. The second point is perhaps a broader point, and it's quite a fascinating topic for me, is that there's research that indicates the obvious, but it's been empiricized by research at least, is that in single party dominance political systems, your overall quality of elected representative deteriorates. And that if we think for it for a moment, it becomes quite clear why. Your dominant parties don't actually have to skills. They don't need to innovate or renew, because the assumption is that they will have power after the next election. So it all becomes effectively gatekeeping. There will be power, there will be opportunity for patronage. I, as a insider, can bank on that. It would be a risk to me to get people in from outside that could threaten my position on guaranteed patronage. So the parties in power, the dominant parties, face very, very limited incentive to actually attract new talent in a dominant party system. On the other side of the aisle, the parties not dominant but in a dominant system fail to attract people from successful business or academic or legal or whatever careers or comfortable retirements to come and sit on the back benches for a term. Right. So for years,
because it feels hopeless. You're like, why would I want to go and be a member of a small party if it's never going to get anywhere near doing actually being able to do anything?
And why do I give up a career that is successful or a retirement that is comfortable to go and do that? It's not just that, you know, you might be unsuccessful. It is that you actually lose either comfort or income by doing that. So if we look at South Africa over the last century, we see the emergence of single party dominance, especially under the National Party and the ANC. And it is no surprise for me that if you sort of read about the CODESA negotiations, you end up in a situation where your most impressive negotiators were from the ANC, who weren't a political party, but a liberation movement where it really was, in a view, dog eat dog. It mattered if you could win. In whatever part of the struggle, you were rewarded if you could deliver. And the DP and the small parties, who actually didn't have massive patronage, so people who went there didn't go there for the comfort of position or gatekeeping. The weakest negotiator, from all accounts, at CODESA was the NP. That makes sense. After 50 years, as a behemothic, lumbering, incumbent, dominant single party, they never had to renew. And that sort of is why you end up in a world where someone like Martinus von Schalkwyk can become leader with limited impressiveness. So we are seeing a similar thing happen with the ANC, where they are suddenly realizing that their human capital is insufficient because they've been dominant for so long. And one of my favorite little nuggets of information from the 1990s is that a short-lived project in the National Party to strategically rejuvenate itself. And Rolf Meyer, the wonderful Rolf Meyer, was tasked with that rejuvenation strategy. And the heart of that strategy, the core of that entire plan, the sort of linchpin that held the rejuvenation of the National Party together, was, as Rolf Meyer acknowledged, he needed to find a black leader for the National Party. That was the extent of the National Party's great hope of rejuvenation. And, you know, Meyer failed, predictably. But we are seeing the same sort of sad desperation going on now for the ANC, that if it can, in the dimes of its dominance, just slightly reassess, just find the right candidates, just readjust now, somehow people will forget how we got here. So beyond the hilarity of perhaps we should have candidates that can read, or not be criminals, beyond that hilarity, there's also the political disconnect of thinking that you can summon up the right political human resources a year or two before an election. Now, it's good for the ANC that they at least at last get to the point of perhaps people should be elected who can do the job. That's fine. That's decent. But politically, I'm afraid it's a bit, you know, it smacks of too little, too late.
You know, I actually have sort of slightly complicated views on some of this, which is that, I mean, obviously, I think it's good news. The ANC says it's not going to put people with criminal records into leadership, candidate positions. I think, let's see if that actually happens, despite the Secretary General's instructions. I'd be surprised if it did. But even further than that, as to, like, for example, a point for illiterate, I actually think there is a space for people who do not have great education qualifications to be a pretty positive influence in elected positions. But they need to do it, A, with the understanding their limitations are, They must seek help and they must seek to, you know, use their position to further themselves. And B, they should definitely be the exception, not the rule, right? You need to have a caucus where almost everyone is a skilled political sort of note taker and reader and things. And then if you have a couple who have, you know, that little sort of intangible X factor, but maybe aren't so, you know, good at reading reports, who can be helped out. I think there's something to be said for that. I think the DA requires a trick to apply for their council positions. I'm not actually sure, which I actually think in some cases can be restrictive. I don't know, Herman, do you know if I'm right on that one?
It sounds right and it rings a bell, but I can't actually say whether you're right or wrong. And I sort of, I do share your position that
considering I've been a councillor for the DA, you'd think I'd remember these things, but no.
Yes, but you have at least.
I do.
I do think that it is worth pointing out that the hilarity in this isn't that they want quality candidates. It is that they have come to this realization after 30 years. Because I do share your view that there is a risk of excluding bona fide community leaders who might not have formal schooling from the political representation.
Or more than that, I don't just mean the basic levels of education. I mean, if your candidate selection process, for example, prioritizes people with master's degrees or PhDs, if your entire political party only chose candidates with PhDs, you would almost certainly be a completely dysfunctional, useless, out-of-touch political party that would have no ability to affect any change whatsoever and would be despised by the population.
And rightly so. I think there's a part of me that gets annoyed by the obsession with formal qualifications in every part of the country, not just in politics, but in employment. I mean, there are people with immense skills who really are hampered by the stigmatization of qualifications. So, and you know, that might come as a surprise, and I might get a flack for that in the comments. But Harry Truman, Winston Churchill, and Saul Plaatje, I think three historically profound and qualified politicians. Not a university degree between the three of them. So I'm not saying that, you know, screw this university degree, not worth anything, or let's demotivate the aspiration for. But it is important to realize that it's not the be all and end all of skills.
Yes.
And especially in politics.
While political parties should definitely have sort of some idea of the criteria of the on paper qualification one from their candidates, that a clever political party, a skilled political party, will have some sort of system in place, probably with good people with good political judgment, who are able to say, okay, you know, this person, an amazing speech. This person has done this amazing bit of community work. This person has unbelievable understanding of this piece of legislation. Regardless of whether they've got, you know, whatever it is next to them. And that's a kind of sort of structure that you can't just magic into existence.
And I think
when it comes to local government elections, you know, having good councillor candidates is one of the keys to making your party successful. It's been one of the reasons why the PA has done so well recently.
Yes. No, I think that's quite right. And from my brief sojourn in politics, my frustration came a lot from how parties think of caucuses. Is if we look at really successful units of people, collectives, it will typically be a team. And in a team, if we take the Springboks, for example, you choose a team for an array of skills. You don't expect 15 players, or what's it, 19 players in a squad, to all be great runners of the ball, great kickers, great strategists, defenders, great attacking players. You pick a team not to average to the brilliant mean. You pick a team that is stronger that is more than the sum of its parts. And that is where a caucus can really become dynamic, is if you understand that in the political space, we need policy understanding, let's say about, 10% of our policy wonks. We need lawyers who can help us understand the defining things, let's say, 5% lawyers. We need engineers to ensure that there's an understanding of the functionalities of local government. We need psychologists or industrial psychologists to understand the processes of human decision-making and operation. Once you get past those sort of formal qualifications, you're not yet at politics. You're just at governance. Then you need to get people who understand communications, people who understand social media, people who understand speech-making, quote-giving, activism, training of activists, So if you are going to look at yours as something that must tick the boxes of excellence from governance perspective, the professions, etc., accounting, law, policy, those stuff, and also appreciate that there's a component that must just be, politics, pressing the flesh, kissing the babies, walking the rope line, getting people to actually turn up to an event. There is space for the whole sort of qualification spectrum of society to get involved. The party must understand the team it is picking within the league it is playing. So the ANC going, right, no criminal qualification, no criminal record. Yeah, that's fine. I think that's good. That's like picking a rugby team and saying, have you ever been guilty of, substance abuse in terms of performance enhancing drugs? It's a good call. But if we do get into the sort of possibly elitist argument that unqualified people must be unskilled people, especially in politics, I think you're in a dangerous game where you are, as you say, risking having massive PhDs, but, no actual political ability to put that governance knowledge into action.
Yeah, no, exactly. These things are a delicate balancing act, and they are also, as you say, driven by these kind of larger things of who is actually up on the day to be your candidates. And I think, every single political party in South Africa struggles with this, partly because our politics is just quite frankly very unsexy. Unless you're going into it for self and the straightforward allure.
Qualifications are overrated. The next thing I want to say is that South Africa's voters, understandably, but South Africa's voters have an abusive relationship with politics in both directions. I think we get abused by those in power, but I've also seen abuse going the other way, particularly at local government level. You've been a councillor. I've worked with councillors. What people don't perhaps know is that most parties or significant parties with institutional organization have suicide watch lists for councillors. Because I once spoke to a councillor, it was 11 o'clock in the morning, and we looked at his phone. He had 713 unread WhatsApps. It was 11 in the morning, not even halfway through the day. The first one arrived 7 minutes past 12 that morning, a complaint from a resident about service delivery. Now, I get it. Collapsing services are a source of immense frustration. And we do get angry, and we do hold politicians responsible for it. But at some point, we have to come to the realization that we are making it as unappealing as possible for people to consider public service. If abuse and blame and a total lack of human understanding is going to be our default when dealing with especially our local ward councillors, do not be surprised when the good ward councillor doesn't stand again. I've had a councillor say to me, if they could get out of the system, they would. And this is an excellent councillor, mind you. This is someone who I would have in the trenches of a war. This is someone who knows what they're doing. So that's part of the abusiveness that I think makes it unappealing. That as this question mark over South African politics, are we sending our best? And this is a book I might urge people to read by Isabel Hardman, titled Why We Get the Wrong Politicians. It's about MPs in the House of Commons and their experience and why, you know, the good ones don't always last. It's very UK specific, but I think there are some general insights. That said, the one invisible benefit from the 2024 elections that I think might in the long run be the big change is that the idea of someone like Leon Schreiber coming from an academic background, joining a party and going on to be Minister of Home Affairs, that is now no longer, you know, outlandish idea. Someone from the banking sector or the financial sector, someone with really with skills to offer, could now possibly look at politics and go, there's a route to public service at a senior level for me that has never existed before because I don't want to join the ANC, but I do want to serve. So my hope is, my suspicion is that over time, the gene pool of South African politics will now grow enriched because the end of single party dominance has also meant the opening of a door of skills and public service that has been closed before. Now, yes, it's small consolation for, you know, what everything else going wrong in politics. But I do think, you know, kudos to the ANC for at least developing some standards. Let's chuckle at them for it taking 30 years. But let's also appreciate that public service is quite often what the public makes of it. So if we want good people in politics, then we should encourage good people to join politics. And once they're there, let's perhaps not abuse them with our very valid frustrations. Let's understand the system, especially local government, enough to understand where the accountability really lies and you know, where our anger should be directed, because we are costing ourselves decent public servants by having a very antagonistic democracy in a way.
Yes, you know, we often talk about this exact phenomenon in the context of people paying or not paying their bills, and the way that people don't want to pay their bills because they feel like government owes them after how badly it's mistreated them, or because you know, they're just being abused by bad resources, bad service delivery anyway, so why should I pay? I'm just a sucker if I pay. So many people get away with, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But of course, this creates this negative cycle where there's no money, so the services get worse, so people don't want to pay. And it's exactly the same thing with the sort of talentedness of politicians. And I think it is a real problem that every South African political party is going to is struggling with. But that being said, I think you're exactly right when you say that 2024, I think, was a bit of a crossover point. And our political system in South Africa very specifically encourages a kind of fragmentation of political power because of our proportional representation things, because of our need for coalitions to build majority governments, which I think is basically going to be the norm just going forward. So the space for a much wider cross-section of society to actually get into positions of political influence and governance is going to be much wider now. And I think that's probably going to be good for the country overall. But yeah, it's going to take also skilled people stepping up and taking the risk to go into public life, which is not always easy, because there's a lot of politicians who deserve a salary of zero, but there's also a lot of politicians who probably deserve to be paid more than they do get.
It's one of those industries where the less you work, the happier you are. You can really hide in politics if you have no work ethic. If you have a work ethic and a sense of duty, I promise you, the system chews you up, spits you out, reverses over you, because it is a place where if you're going to work, you're going to work hard. If you're not going to work, you're going to cruise. It is an unhealthy system, and I genuinely, if anyone ever thinks, particularly in a local government context, that being a ward councillor, all politicians are trash. Yeah, I urge you just to perhaps have a human conversation with a ward councillor, and check with them about, you know, the abuse they get, about things that by law they can do nothing about.
All right, and on that, I don't know what to call it. Is it an anti-populist note? Is it a
sobering,
unpopular note? A sobering note, a thoughtful note, whatever it may be. Please direct your metaphorical rotten tomatoes for us defending the much reviled politicians in the comments. And yeah, we will see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone. Have a good day. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.